Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the July meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from the Samoset Resort in Rockport on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Before I introduce today's speaker, I want to make sure that all of you know that the Midcoast Forum will be sponsoring a debate on foreign policy among the three candidates vying to replace Olympia Snowe: the Democrat Cynthia Dill, the Republican Charlie Summers, and the independent ex-governor Angus King. That debate is scheduled for Thursday, October 11th from 6 to 7:30 at the Camden Opera House. More about it later, but you can write it down in your calendar for the fall. Now today, the forum is delighted to introduce Professor Joshua Landis, a Syrian expert. Joshua is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies and associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma, where he teaches modern Middle Eastern history and politics and writes on Syria and its surrounding countries. Dr. Landis writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter on Syrian politics that attracts over 3,000 readers a day and is widely read by officials in Washington, Europe, and of course Syria. Dr. Landis regularly travels to Washington, D.C. to consult with the State Department and other government agencies. He's a frequent analyst on TV and radio, most recently on the Jim Lehrer NewsHour, Charlie Rose Show, CNN, Fox News. He's been widely quoted in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and comments frequently for NPR as well as BBC. He's spoken at the Brookings, the Middle East Institute, the Council on Foreign Relations. He was educated at Swarthmore, got his MA at Harvard, and his PhD from Princeton. He began his Middle East career as a teaching fellow in 1979 at Beirut's International College, one of the great educational institutions in the Middle East. He has lived on and off for over 14 years in the Middle East and has received numerous grants, including three Fulbrights. So we are delighted to have Joshua here to tell us about Syria. The topic, a policy of regime change in Syria, ?
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to be back in the beauties of Maine, even more beautiful this time than last time. And I want to thank particularly the Mid-Coast Forum, not the Mid-East Forum. I guess it seems like it sometimes. I would like to thank Jim Algrant, who sends me his Clipper special regularly, and we correspond frequently. And I'd like to particularly this time thank Mac DeFord, who has hosted me, and his wife, Zara, who have hosted me so wonderfully overlooking the ocean. And I got to go swim immediately after getting off the plane yesterday. It's really a pleasure to be here in the beauties of Maine. I'm going to break my talk into two parts. One part is really the larger view and some history. The second part is what is America doing? What might Syria look like after this? Various scenarios and what it does to the Middle East. Let me begin with the history, the big view. Back in December, I wrote an article for Middle East Policy, which was entitled something like "Doomed, but Long and Bloody." The Syrian regime is doomed because it's a minoritarian regime, the last of the minoritarian regimes in the Middle East, but it's long and bloody because it's a minoritarian regime. let me unpack that a little bit. When the Ottoman Empire collapsed in 1918 and the British and French divided up the 11 states, that's Lebanon, Iraq, Palestine, Syria, by the time they left the Second World War, all of the states that they had been occupying became ruled by minorities. And that's largely because they rested, the colonial powers leaned on minorities in order to secure their rule, in order to put down Arab nationalist forces that rose up against them. They recruited minority help. And in Syria, that was particularly true, and it was the Alawites who became recruited into the military. But this created a problem in the post-colonial era, which was minoritarian states. And Lebanon, on the coast, was dominated by Maronite Christians, by Christians overall, but Maronite Christians, Catholic Christians. The presidency and the chief of staff were Maronites. In parliament, 6 out of every 11 deputies had to be Christian. Only 5 were Muslim. In Iraq, the British placed the Sunnis, 20% of the population, in government, over the Shiites, who were 60%, and of course the Kurds, another 20%. So, and in, you can even add Palestine, Israel, into this, because the Jews in 1948, when Britain left, were 1/3 of the population of Palestine. In Syria, it was the Alawites. 12% of Syrians are Alawites, a religious minority. They lived in the mountains on the coast, right above the Maronites and the Christians in Lebanon. The mountains that extend up towards Turkey are called the Alawite Mountains. They're heterodox Shiites, quite different from even Shiite Muslims. They don't practice the 5 pillars of Islam. They believe that Ali, the son-in-law of the Prophet, is the mana, or the meaning, the essence of the God, of the divine creator, that Muhammad is only his face, or the outward, the hijab, the veil, an outward appearance. And they have a trinity, like Christians, Salman Pharisee is the bab, or the spokesperson. But any rate, they're quite believe in reincarnation of souls. They don't have mosques. They have saints' shrines that they visit on Friday. They drink wine and alcohol. They can eat ham. They don't wear veils. The women don't have a headscarf or any covering. So their traditions and their religion is really very different. And they, throughout Islamic history, have been defined as non-Muslims. Only recently did they get legally defined as Muslims. That's a very modern 20th century thing. And in what, some ways, when I teach my classes, I say the Alawites are the Mormons of Syria. They add a book and they add a prophet. If you're a liberal Muslim, you say that's fine. They believe in Muhammad. They believe in the Quran. That's good enough for me. God will be the decider. If you're a fundamentalist or a literalist in any way, you say it's beyond the pale. They can't do that. They're not Muslims, and they can't be the president. In the constitution of Syria, it says the president must be a Muslim. So this creates problems for them, unlike in the United States, where we all know Mitt Romney is welcomed with open arms. And but at least there's separation of church and state in the United States, so that's theoretically not a problem, where it's a cultural problem, but not a political problem directly. The Alawites were recruited into the military by the French, as were all minorities, because when the French occupied in 1920, almost immediately they were met by an uprising, a nationalist uprising. It was led by Sunni Muslims in the cities. And in order to suppress them, they needed an army. They got local recruits, and the people who were happy to shoot at the Sunnis were the minorities who had been oppressed by them, and particularly the Alawites, who were the poorest of the poor in Syria, living in the mountains, who, during the Ottoman period, had not been defined as Muslims, could not give testimony in a court of law. You can go through a long litany of their oppression. They have this rather lachrymose interpretation of history, where they are the victims. And this justifies to themselves, to a certain extent, the brutality of the present regime. But they, by the 1950s, about 60% of the non-commissioned officers in the Syrian army were Alawite. Within a decade, by 1966, the Alawites had taken over the military in a coup d'etat, and they took with it the leadership of the state. So Alawites have dominated the political scene in Syria since 1966. Hafs al-Assad beat out other Alawites and carried out the last coup in 1970. And his family, the Assad family, has dominated Syria since 1970. So for the last 42 years, the Assads, the father, Hafs al-Assad, and Bashar since 2000, have ruled Syria politically. And they have, we'll talk about the nature of the minoritarian regime. But that, they are in the last of the minoritarian regimes that were established at the end of the Second World War. The Maronite Christians were pushed out of power in Lebanon in a brutal civil war that lasted from 1975 to 90, 15 long years. In a country of less than 3 million people at the time, 200,000 were killed, a million left the country, and others were internally displaced. So it was long and bloody. Casting out a minoritarian regime is very difficult. They don't like it. It's seen as a zero-sum game. Because in all of these Levantine states, which were not nations, the British and French brought together people of different religions and different ethnic background and sort of stuck them together and said, you know, make a go at it. And they, in every one of these countries, they have failed to come up with a happy national understanding, national pact, if you will. And they're still struggling to do it in every one of these countries. Iraq, of course, the minoritarian regime collapsed more quickly, but that's because the U.S. Army went in and rota-rooted the Iraqi state in 2003 and cast the Sunnis down to the bottom of society and brought the Shiites up and put them at the top, believing that that would bring democracy if you put the 60% up at the top. And it has brought something, at least it's put the majority community at the top. So even if we're seeing emerge a Shiite dictatorship in Iraq today, at least it's a dictatorship of the majority population. So I guess it'll have to be less brutal than if you have a minoritarian state. At least that would be, I suppose, the hope. But it's been long and bloody. The Sunnis in Iraq are very unhappy about being cast to the bottom. And they're still blowing off bombs almost every day. In Baghdad, car bombs go off. And some days, at least until recently, the death rate in Iraq has been higher than in Syria. So the Sunnis are still, if you will, on the warpath, unhappy. And we just saw today that there were 6 or 7 coordinated bombs go off in Iraq, ignited by Sunnis against the Shiite government, because the Sunnis are trying to recapture a hunk of the state. In Israel, Palestine, of course, the Muslims in 1948 thought, as two-thirds of the population, thought that they would beat the Jews and that they would set up shop and the Jews would be a minority. Of course, they failed. The Jews won the war of 48, and 800,000 Palestinians fled or were forced to flee from Palestine and were not allowed to come back. That was out of a population of 1.4 million or something like that. About half the more than half the Palestinians became refugees. And Jews were ingathered from around the world, from the Middle East. 50% of Israelis are Asian Jews, and the other 50% European Jews. So the Jewish population of Palestine was more creative and, I guess, a little bit more daring, and were able to turn themselves into the majority. And so they solved their minoritarian problem through long warfare. And as we all know, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is not over. The Palestinians are still fighting to get a hunk of that territory, to get some self-determination. So that's 60 years of constant warfare, long and bloody, again, because it's a zero-sum game. And that's the context in the region. And the Alawites now are on the verge of falling. in December, everybody thought the Alawites are going to be gone. The state would collapse quickly after this uprising first began. The head of the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria already in the summer of 2011 said they've got 2-3 months at the most. The State Department announced that Bashar al-Assad was a dead man walking well before the turn of the year. And others, the Israeli defense minister said they've got another few weeks. Everybody thought the regime would just collapse. In December, I wrote this article saying that Bashar is going to last to 2013. It's going to be long and bloody. Now, I may be wrong. It looks today as if the regime is coming undone much more rapidly now that defections have reached the very top of Sunni society, as we've seen recently, with top Sunnis defecting. The bomb that went off that destroyed the security leadership looks like it was an inside job by people clearly who are working with the opposition, and they're getting good information from the very top. And the fighting has moved into Damascus and Aleppo, the two major urban centers which had stood with the regime. The upper classes had been standing with the regime. And now it looks like that has collapsed. So the Sunni Alawite alliance that's at the bedrock of the Assad regime is crumbling very quickly. And the Alawites are increasingly standing alone in the military. But we can't expect the regime to just collapse. You know, on one hand, you think, oh, it's going to cascade. From now on, it's just going to be a series of disasters. It's going to go very quickly, and within a few weeks, it's going to be over. And the opposition is saying that. This is, you know, a few days, a week. But that's unlikely to... Let me continue with my argument, because the state is quite strong in a perverse way, because it's a minoritarian state. Bashar al-Assad and his father before him had planned for this day of uprising for 40 years. The entire officer corps, 70%, we believe, of the top officer corps, in both the intelligence and the military, are Alawite. Hafs al-Assad, when he took over in the 70s, discovered that the secret to ruling Syria was family values. It took a village to rule Syria. He relied on traditional loyalties. His family first, his village, in-laws, and then the sect, the Alawite sect. Those loyalties would be the pillars of his regime, because Arab nationalism was not doing it. But Syria had been a banana republic, in a sense, of the Middle East, had been the banana republic of the Middle East. About 20 coups, successful and unsuccessful, between 1949 and 1970. Constant changes of government. Assad brought that to an end by using these traditional loyalties and putting his brother in charge of the Republican Guard and protecting their leadership in Damascus, and then cousins and so forth arrayed outwards. And that's the model that Bashar al-Assad inherited, and it's the model that he replicated. He used he showed no imagination. He talked about the China model, that he would keep politics the same to assure the continuation of the regime, but he would modernize the economy, try to increase the growth rate, open Syria up, turn it into a trading emporium, and try to put a chicken in everybody's pot. That's what he promised in 2000 when he came to power. Of course, he failed at doing that. But that was the strength. It's the weakness of the regime. It's a minoritarian regime, but it's also the strength. Because when you compare it to Egypt, Tunisia, Mubarak allowed both of his sons to go into international banking and to make gobs of money, become crony capitalists. Hafs al-Assad sent his sons to the military to get military training so that they would be part of this structure that was defending the state. Bashar's brother is the head of the Republican Guard today, in the same way that Hafs al-Assad's brother, Rifat al-Assad, was in charge of the Republican Guard before. Sons of the same people were made and put into the same positions. About the 17 people that Hafsam Assad found to be his top guys in the 1970s were there when he died. Very much unlike Saddam Hussein, who constantly had purges, killed members of his own family, was putting everybody back on their heels all the time. The Assads were a functional family, if you will, and they kept the same people in the same places for 30 years. And Bashar repeated that. Manaf Talas, this very high commander that defected 2 weeks ago, his father had been defense minister under Hafs al-Assad from 1972 to 2002, had helped with the transition. And then Manaf Talas, the son, wanted to be defense minister. And some people believe that he had defected because he was denied the post of defense minister, but he had been very high in the regime and a close intimate of Bashar's. That's why it was so important that he defected. It showed that people from the very top and close to Bashar were beginning to leave the regime. But that's the model. It's the strength and the weakness. Extremely narrow regime. The other major reason why this Arab Spring hit Syria so hard, I think, is the economy. Bashar al-Assad had failed. He needed to remake the regime and find a new way, a new foundation. Many people said he needed to talk to the Muslim Brotherhood, the Sunni Muslims. The father had crushed them brutally in Hama in 1982 and outlawed the organization. Capital punishment if you belong to the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. Many people said if Bashar had only made peace with them, brought them back in, stopped this proscribing them in this way, and tried to negotiate with them. The trouble with that is his regime probably would have fallen had he made those kinds of concessions and brought them in, because he's a minority regime. We found in the WikiLeaks most recently revealed on Syrian internal documents a letter just a year ago, an email from Bashar. The big question inside Syria had been decentralization. We need administrative reform, too corrupt, decision-making is not being done at the local level. Let's decentralize. That was the big push. Bashar finally wrote a letter saying, no, we can't do this. Why? Because if we decentralize, he said, the Muslim extremists, meaning Muslim Brotherhood, will gain power in the provinces. And very quickly, they'll want power at the center. So we can't risk it. And that was the political calculation that he made time and time again. And that's the danger of being a minoritarian state, is that you exclude everybody, and eventually you can't sustain it. In this day of popular protest and democratic yearning, minoritarian regimes have fallen throughout the entire region, and Syria is hanging on. And that economic basis, if he could have done the China model and grown at 8 or 9%, the way Turkey is growing at 8 or 9%, he might have extended his rule. And in many ways, you can see the monarchies, or at least the Gulf states, have done that. They have the money to buy off the population. But the essential authoritarian bargain that is at the heart of every Middle Eastern regime collapsed in the last few decades. Every regime, whether monarchy or authoritarian, since the 1960s, has constructed this authoritarian bargain. They subsidize, they give jobs to college graduates. They're low-paying, often do-nothing jobs. But they're jobs, and they provide security. Subsidies, fuel oil, heating, rice, cooking oil, the basic foodstuffs, bread, are subsidized. Egypt spends over 10% of its annual budget on bread and fuel subsidies. Syria is doing the same thing, and that's true for Algeria. It's true right across the entire Middle East. Now, as population boomed, and when Hafs al-Assad constructed the Syrian state in the 1970s, there were about 7, 8 million Syrians. Today, there are 24 million Syrians. So those subsidies have exploded, not unlike, you know, healthcare or something like that in America, where it became this monster that the Syrian state could not pay for. It was not productive. And the authoritarian bargain had collapsed. There was not enough water, not enough jobs to go around, and not enough money to subsidize. So Assad was busy trying to liberalize. But the liberalization didn't create jobs for the poor. It created jobs for the rich, and money streamed in for the top 5%. Anybody who's been in Syria in the last decade has seen a country that has blossomed. If you've got money, if you're a tourist, it's a wonderful place to visit. But for the bottom 50%, Syria was crumbling. Poverty rates were going up. The last UN report showed that 32% of Syrians were living on $2 a day or less. Almost half of Syrians were spending 50% of their income on food alone. Syria experienced a terrible drought over the last 5 years, and commodity prices were screaming up. Over the last 2 years, wheat prices alone have doubled. Now, we don't notice that bread went from $2 to $4 a loaf over the last 2 years because we're so rich that we close our eyes as we go to Sam's Club or whatever it is, I guess. Maybe I'm exaggerating. But it doesn't make a big difference. But if you're spending 50% of your income on a few food items and they go up 100%, you notice it. And this was crushing. In Egypt, 40% of the people live on $2 a day or less. In Yemen, it's even more. And unemployment was growing leaps and bounds. Syria, the median age is 21 years old. Half of all Syrians are 21 or below. Now, this is a major reason why it's unlikely that democracy is going to blossom in Syria anytime soon, because there's only two social indicators that social scientists have found any correlation to democracy, that seem to correlate to democracy promotion. One is per capita GDP. Two is your age. If the population is 30 or older, the chances are more than 50% that democracy will stick and you won't have a coup d'etat or fall back into authoritarianism. And the other is if you have $6,000-$7,000 per capita GDP. In Syria, the per capita is about $2,000 to $3,000, and it's falling rapidly because we've got sanctions and the economy has fallen apart. The median age is 21. Iraq is 21 too. Egypt is about 24-5. Tunisia is 30. So Tunisia, there's some chance that they'll stick with, you know, the democracy will work out. Less chance than other places. Okay, that's the larger view. The authoritarian Barkin collapsed. The minoritarian regime had been outdated and is sitting there alone of all the other states around it that have collapsed into bloody civil war. What about policy? I think Obama has been very smart not to lead on Syria, not to get us into Syria. Now, obviously, there are many political reasons why he couldn't get into Syria after trying to make a mess of it. America proved that it was not good at nation building in the Middle East, not in Iraq, not in Afghanistan. Trying to do the same thing in Syria would be a fool's errand. Oh, of course, you might get, you know, third time's a charm and all that. The U.S. is radioactive in the Arab and Muslim, and particularly the Arab world. All the popularity polls show that people don't trust us. Democracy, as I've already said, is very unlikely to emerge out of the Syrian context. Syria will be extremely expensive to rebuild. It has nothing that the world wants. It doesn't export anything, a few phosphates and olive oil and cotton. But its oil is run out. It's a very poor country. The opposition in their last Friends of Syria meeting asked for $12 billion of startup money after Assad falls for the first 6 months. But that's chump change. We are spending today over $4 billion a month in Afghanistan. And at our height in Iraq, we were spending $7 or $8 billion a month. So if we were to get into Syria, if we had gotten into Syria and then been responsible for helping rebuild, it would have been a very expensive endeavor. And there is no chance the Syrians can pay for it. Their electricity runs for only several hours a day. Their schooling system is broken down. The transport system is everything. All the infrastructure in Syria is disintegrating, which was one of the problems that Bashar had faced. So for those reasons, it was smart, I think, for Obama, and it has been smart for him not to get in. I think those are the principal reasons why he's been very loath, not to mention that politically it's unpopular in America. All the polls show that Americans don't want the U.S. to do even a Libya. Increasingly, that's as the death rate goes up in Syria, of course, people become more sympathetic to a Libya-type bombing campaign. But even then, you break it, you own it. Because the danger is, in a multi-religious, multi-ethnic society like Syria's, if you decapitate the regime the way we did in Libya or Iraq, the death rate could very easily go up if civil war breaks out. And in Syria today, there are over 100 militias. None of them are taking orders from any command control structure. There is a free Syrian army. That is, the putative leader lives in Turkey as a colonel. But all the military say that they do not follow his orders, and they don't take orders from anybody. So the Free Syrian Army is a franchise, if you will, but it's not giving any orders. The attempts by America to help construct the Syrian National Council and so forth have exploded in America's hands, and the leadership has squabbled. They've had several changes. They just recently had a change of leadership. They've only laid out that the term of the head of the Syrian National Council is for 3 months. And then they have to replace the person because they can't agree. The last leader of the Syrian National Council was appointed. There was no vote. And appointed by the Muslim Brotherhood, which seems to be the largest group there. But they didn't want to have elections. They appointed a Kurd in the name of not being too Muslim and not being too Arab. But everybody inside the council immediately criticized this action bitterly for not being democratic, inscrutable, and that this Kurd had no power, not even amongst Kurds. He was put there as a nice sort of liberal figurehead so that the Americans would not blame the Syrian National Council for being too Muslim Brotherhood and for social relations. So that's the mess that America is looking into. Now, of course, the death rate in Syria is getting worse and worse. But the tractations with Russia, UN, all seem to be really surpassed by events on the ground. The military situation is changing so rapidly. Today, the real question is, when will Bashar lose Damascus? We've seen the fighting in the last week moving into the heart of Damascus. Now, the rebels took over one major neighborhood in the heart of Damascus for a day. They got immediately destroyed. But in doing it, the Syrian military, had to damage very badly an entire sort of middle-class neighborhood, which is turning the Damascenes into rebels. And I think now the logic of this uprising has really turned into a sectarian logic. The Sunni rebels against the Alawite military. And the military is becoming an Alawite militia. And some Washington folks are suggesting that once Assad loses Damascus, he will repair back the Alawite mountains on the coast, a region that was its own state, an autonomous state under the French, and try to create something like Hezbollah, an Alawite militia that would dominate the coastal territory and set up, in a sense, an Alawite state. I think this is very unlikely. 2 days ago, I wrote an article on my blog saying, you know, 5 reasons why there will not be an Alawite state. And that's largely because the Alawites have tried to come out of the mountains. Bashar bent over backwards to try to make Alawites Muslims, integrate them in, bring them to the cities where they had not lived previously. And he married a Sunni wife. All the efforts have been to integrate, not to separate. There are no particularist institutions amongst the Alawites. He's prepared in no way for this, psychologically, politically, or economically. There is no international airport in the region. There are no power plants in the region. There's nothing on which to build a national economy. And anyway, if the Sunnis unite, dominate Damascus, they will make very short work, I think, of any attempt to establish an Alawite hinterland or for the troops to fall back in these mountains. I don't think they're defensible. They're defendable. And now that, of course, assumes that there will be a unity within the rest of Syria. If, of course, Syria breaks up into militias battling for authority, then Alawites could survive for some time in their mountains. But that's not likely to last for very long. I think Syria will end up being a unified state. The Kurds have some Kurds have ambitions to break away the northeast. There are 10% Kurds in Syria. Most of them live in the northeast near Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan. Some of them would like to separate the northeast, where much of the oil is, and join it to a larger Kurdistan. But they're not a majority. The Arabs are the majority, even in the northeast. They're about 35-40% of that population. So they would have a very hard time breaking away. And a lot of people see Syria as breaking up. An Alawite state, Kurdish state, this kind of thing. I don't think that's likely. But it presents many problems for the United States in this sort of, what's it likely to look like? And what problems does it present in the neighborhood? I'm not going to go into those now. I will leave you with that interpretation of how things have unfolded, why it's so difficult getting rid of this regime, and I believe why it'll be very difficult to sew Syria back together. This is just, once the Assad regime falls, there's still going to be a very difficult time unifying the nation, because these were not nation states in 1920 when the French and the British finalized the borders. And we've seen that in Lebanon, where the three major religious communities look across a big cultural divide at each other very warily. In Iraq, where the Sunnis and Shiites are still blowing each other up and where the Kurds have all but separated. And in Palestine, where Jews and Muslims have found very little to join them and a great deal to separate them. So on that rather lugubrious note, I will conclude the formal part of this lecture. Thank you very much. Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Joshua. That's terrific. It's always, well, there wasn't any optimism, was there?
No, there wasn't a lot.
Okay, we'll start with the first question. If Syria were, even temporarily, to fragment, won't Iraqi Kurdistan be inclined to separate and join Syria and Kurdistan? I mean, could the whole Kurdish thing begin to explode or unravel?
It could, and this is a primary reason why Turkey has been so loath to get involved directly into Syria. For the same reason that they refused to allow American troops to cross Turkey in 2003, because they were worried about Kurds separating from Iraq and becoming an independent state and then animating this long war between Kurds and Turks in Turkey. And over the last 30 years, almost 40,000 Turks and Kurds have been killed in eastern Turkey because of this ongoing insurgency. The Erdogan government had tamped that down, and it had begun looking for a political outcome when the Iraq war started that gave a second life. In many ways, Turkey thought it had, I think, come to terms with Kurdistan and was hoping that Kurdistan in Iraq would be sort of like Israel, that it would provide a national fulfillment for Kurdish national desires, but that Kurds within Turkey would be happy to stay in Turkey, work in Turkey, participate in the 8% growth rate, and in a successful state, but could see national fulfillment in Iraq for their desires. This Syria problem opens that issue up again. And just yesterday, a friend who's in Iraq wrote to me and said that, in Kurdish part of Iraq, said that everybody, the newspapers there, had published that they're arming Syrian Kurds, and they've sent 1,000, you know, Kurdish fighters have gone into Syria to help them take over the towns from Assad and to establish an autonomous region within Syria. So, you know, that's the beginning of this sort of, and the Syrian Kurds are demanding national recognition from the Syrian opposition within the Syrian context. But they want the recognition as Kurds as a nation, a national minority, and autonomy. That's their two demands. And the Arabs, Syrians, don't want to, they'll give them some autonomy, but they don't want to go, they see this as a slippery slope. And so the Kurds have not joined the opposition movement because they see them as being still rather ethnically prejudiced. So yes, it's a major problem and it's a worry.
Okay, I've got two questions that I'm going to tie together. I'll let you tie together, Joshua. The first one is, should the U.S. policy be to ignore Syria and just let it collapse? And the other one that I want you to work into this is, how much danger is that fighting in Syria will lead to a wider regional war, in which case us letting that happen would be a disaster?
Right. The U.S. is not ignoring Syria. The U.S. policy is not to get troops, not to get implicated militarily, so that's responsible for putting Syria back together again. But we are, our strategy is to starve the regime and feed the opposition, to change the balance of power internally, to promote regime change. Our official policy is to get rid of Assad. Now, of course, we want to do that a little bit by remote control, which complicates the situation. But we have starved the regime along with the entire nation by putting very severe sanctions on Syria, which have sent this economy into a spiral downwards. Today, the economy is, the currency has lost 40% of its value. Yeah, I could go through a string of economic woes that beset Syrian middle class. So the economic sanctions were a very key part in bringing down this government. Feeding the opposition, Qatar and Saudi Arabia had promised to pay for the arms and put the opposition on salary. You can't do better than that as America. Why? The American taxpayers do not want to pay. Why not let the Saudis do it? You know, when we went into Afghanistan in the 1980s, in the 70s and 80s, we had a 50-50 sharing agreement with the Saudis, where we paid for 50% of the Mujahideen, provided the Stinger missiles, and the Saudis did the other 50%. Of course, that ended in Al-Qaeda, but this effort is sort of a 90-10. So it's a much better for America because the Saudis are footing the bill. So they are providing arms. In the last few weeks, it seems that a lot of arms have come to the border. That's what a number of reporters are suggesting in Saudis, that they've really been shoveling the arms in. So that, and America is trying to help those arms get to, you know, the George Washingtons rather than the Bin Ladens. Clearly the CIA, if they're doing anything in Syria, have been ordered, you know, don't let this turn out the way Afghanistan turned out, which is a tall order because there are 100 and some odd militias and they don't know who these commanders are. There isn't a litmus test they can make, and the Saudis are moving arms through their own people, through Beirut and Turkey, who are largely Muslim Brotherhood types. So it's very hard for the CIA, if they're not spending the money and giving the arms, for them to control where they go to.
Okay, let's try to spread it out a little bit from Syria. What's going to be the impact on Hezbollah?
Okay, the regional question. Is it going to start a First World War? Let me just start with that one first. I think it's very unlikely. Everybody said, if we invade Iraq and destroy Saddam Hussein, it's going to start the First World War in the Middle East. Everybody will jump in and it'll be proxy armies. But people very quickly realized Iraq is a swamp. The Turks didn't want to get in. The Iranians didn't really want to get in. The Saudis didn't want to get in. You know, only the Americans were stupid enough to get into Iraq. And nobody jumped in after them. And most people have stayed out because they don't really understand what's going on. They don't want to get sucked in. And I think Syria will be very much like that. I don't think anybody, you know, already America has spent the last 6 months trying to push the Turks into Syria, get the Saudis and the Arab League to take charge. They wanted, you know, Obama was constantly saying, I'm willing to follow, but I'm not going to go first. We've had enough of going first. And he was pushing everybody up to the plate, and nobody wanted to do it because they understand. There's nothing in it for them in Syria except for a world of woe. And I think that is unlikely. Now, there are going to be ramifications. And clearly, it's going to change the balance of power if a Shiite regime falls and a Sunni Syria emerges in its place, which is the likely thing to happen. That's going to realign Syria. Today, Syria is an ally of Iraq, Shiite Iraq, Iran, most importantly, and Hezbollah, Shiite southern Lebanon militia. And that's called by many the Shiite Crescent. And of course, it's pitted against the Sunni moon, or I don't know what it is down there, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Egypt increasingly. Turkey has tried to be a mediator. And Israel, oddly enough, has allied themselves, of course, in this pro-American Sunni alliance against bad Iran over domination of the Gulf and leadership in the Middle East. So taking out Syria is a major boon, if you will, for American strategists and for Israel, because it chops this Shiite crescent in half, will flip Syria from being pro-Iran to pro-Saudi and theoretically pro-American, and it will change one of the major states, the vectors of the major states, in a pro-American way. This will isolate Hezbollah. The major arms got to Hezbollah from Iran through Syria. They won't be able to do that anymore. And it'll be, you know, theoretically, Syria would then make peace with Israel and all of Israel's neighbors, and Lebanon would very quickly, and all of Israel's neighbors would be at peace with it, and you would have solved the Arab-Israeli conflict, except for the poor Palestinians who would, I guess, continue to have troubles. But this could be a major boon for the United States, but it opens up problems then with a Sunni state next to Iraq, which is Shiite. And it would cause the Sunnis in Lebanon to try to take down Hezbollah a notch or two. But Lebanon, I think, is, you know, most people worry about Lebanon. I think Lebanon has found an equilibrium. No Sunnis believe today in Lebanon that they're going to be able to take on Hezbollah anytime soon. So I don't see them sort of launching a war against Hezbollah, thinking we're going to take them down and do what Israel couldn't do in 2006. You know, there'll be pushing and shoving, as we've seen already. A few people killed here or there. Iraq is where there's likely to be the most damage. As we saw today, there's 6 bombs went off, Al-Qaeda. If Syria becomes Sunni, and there are militias that still have power, they're likely to help the Sunni militias in Iraq try to gain more power. And it'll be interesting for Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries to jump on and to fund some of this, thinking that they're going to shrink Shiite power in Iraq and really contain Iran. And that's where I see the biggest action is probably in Iraq, which is so unsettled, and where Sunnis and Shiites are fighting each other today.
I think we've got 4 questions on why is Russia and China supporting Assad. I think you've pretty much answered it in terms of the boon that it would be for the United States if you end
let
up
me,
with
let me
Sunni,
touch on that.
Maybe you have something else.
Let me touch on that. I think that, you know, the Russians and Chinese came to agreement that they were going to draw the line at Syria. And Iran is the real white elephant in the room for both the Russians and the Chinese. Their position is based on Syria, Iran. If they let Syria go, of course, America's policy for Iran is regime change. And if Syria goes, it'll be the domino theory in their minds, I think, that then the whole world will focus on turning out the Islamic Republic from Iran. And this would be a major strategic blow for both Russia and China. Not too long ago, I was in China on an East-West confab for energy and the Middle East's role in that. And I was shocked at the reaction of the Chinese officials who looked at us Americans and said, why are you pursuing an anti-China policy in the Middle East? And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, everywhere, you know, we are trying to lift up hundreds of millions of impoverished Chinese into the middle class. That's our biggest ambition. And to do that, we need to continue the economic miracle of China and get cheap energy to feed this economic miracle. Everywhere we turn to get energy in the Middle East, you put sanctions. Libya, Sudan, Iraq, Syria, Iran. We've got wells and oil concerns in every one of these countries. And you turn around and sanction them and try to get us out. You're trying to destroy China. They truly believe this was an anti-China policy. Of course, the Americans turned to them and said, no, you know, you're the selfish people. We're trying to help the good people in the Middle East and hurt the bad people. And you should be helping us instead of helping the bad people and hurting the good people. The Chinese looked confused and said, we are helping the good people, our people. And so we had very different points of view. And the Chinese said, we want stability in the Middle East. And you trying to overturn the states in these countries that you've sanctioned, and particularly Iran, is going to destabilize our fuel. And China gets 20% of its fuel, of its energy imports from Iran. They've invested billions in the gas and oil fields of Iran. So they do not want to see the government overturned and a no pro-American government put in there that would maybe be anti-China. So that's, I think, the Russians and the Chinese have sort of drawn a line at Syria. They may not be happy with that line today as Assad crumbles, but it's very hard to change policies once you've established them. I mean, we got into Vietnam or in Iraq, and I'm sure that 6 years before we got out of either of those countries, we were thinking we'd made a mistake. But it's very difficult to change those policies once you've laid them down. And I think Russia and China find themselves in that situation in Syria today.
We're going to end. We've got time for one more. We're already over time. But this is an interesting historical question. I'd love to have some insights from you on this. How did the Ottoman Empire manage to rule these different groups for so long?
Well, that's a good, you know, the Ottoman Empire.
And is there anything we could learn from what they did? Yeah.
Well, the Ottoman Empire, of course, was completely different. They used the same family values that the Assads used and that the monarchies use. They had a dynastic monarchy where loyalty was to the man, the caliphate, and, of course, to religion. Islamic empire writ large. And they allowed for a lot of federalism and loose, you know, in this multi-ethnic, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But of course, it was an age before nationalism had remade the map of the earth, creating 200 nation states that we know and love today. And those multi-ethnic empires, sprawling multi-ethnic empires, worked well because they were tolerant, by and large. They gave a lot of liberty to people in the provinces. They weren't too scrupulous about bookkeeping. And they had some simple loyalty, family, and religion. Nationalism has turned all that on its head. The Ottomans, you can't do that in a sense. Now, the key, clearly, for a country like Syria is to try to find a liberal environment. The trouble with, in order to overturn a government like Syria's, you need Islam, and you need a rather fundamentalist Islam, because you need martyrdom. It's very difficult to fight against an entrenched authoritarian regime. And in order to sacrifice for Syrians today, they're becoming more Muslim all the time. They have been over the last 30 years, becoming much more pious, much more Sunni, in order to sort of get their strength to go against this regime and to die by the thousands. And that requires jihadism to a certain degree. And that's why Al-Qaeda, in a sense, has been welcomed in Syria today, because who wouldn't want Al-Qaeda in their, you know, in their trench in a war like this? Al-Qaeda knows how to fight. They've done it around. They know weapons. So the Islamists that have come in from the outside are playing an important role in teaching, instructing, in helping. I think most Syrians will not want them around once the fighting is done, because they're not good at nation building. And in many ways, Syria's challenge is going to be, of course, to unite around something fairly liberal, to bring together the many different minorities in Syria and ethnic groups into a whole. Syria opposition can win this revolution being divided. And some people have even said that not having a leader and having lots of little militias may even be an advantage, because a regime cannot deal a death blow by capturing your leaders. It can't find you. The real trouble, though, is once the regime falls, how do you rebuild a nation without that kind of unity? And that's going to be the big challenge of Syria. And to unify the country, one's going to need a certain amount of liberalism, because it is a very diverse country. And diversity has been the enemy of unification in this region. And if I may, in 2 minutes, Turkey, if we want to take the model of Turkey, which has been so successful, in some reasons, Turkey's success has been that it ethnically cleansed in the First World War. And that's a perverse statement, I know. But 20% of Anatolia were Christians before the First World War. Turkey killed the Armenians and chased them out, about 1.5 million. And it did a population transfer with the Greek Orthodox and all of the various Christian sects that were sent to Greece. Many of them fled to Syria. Many of the Syrian Christians are from Anatolia originally. They wiped out over 3 million Christians from Anatolia. Erdogan, in establishing an Islamic-lite democracy, has been successful in doing that, in part because there are no Christians. The Kemalists, the Ataturkists, who are secular, were terrified of his government. They said, oh, another Iran, this is going to be like the mullahs in Iran. And they fought tooth and nail against Erdogan's constitutional changes that destroyed the military leadership. But they're all Muslims, and they could put up with it. If there had been 20% Christians in Turkey today, they would have sided with the Kemalists and the generals who dominated and didn't and disbanded parliament every 10 years. And it's very likely that Turkey would not have had a democratic, soft democratic transition, that it might have gotten blocked in an authoritarian government, and there could have been civil strife because of it, and greater Islamic extremism. Syria has all of that diversity, like Lebanon and Iraq. But there is, 70% of Syrians are Sunni Arabs. And that gives one some hope that they will emerge from this time of turmoil and be able to unify the country around this big majority, a majority that is not present in Lebanon, not present amongst the Palestinians in countering the Jews, and not present in Iraq either. The 60% Shiites is, of course, important, and it has been the heart of this remaking Iraq. But 70% Sunni Arabs is even bigger in Syria, and it gives you hope that Syria will come out of this, will unify, and will reconstruct a Syria that is a going nation state. Thank you.